Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The steady flow of UN aid trucks filled with vital humanitarian relief crossing from southern Turkey into northwest Syria to help people affected by last week's earthquake disaster will continue every day for as long as the needs are there, UN aid teams said on Friday. Since the 9th of February, 143 trucks have passed through the Bab al-Hawa and Bab al-Salam border crossings, according to the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA. As part of the UN-wide response, the World Food Programme, WFP, has delivered assistance to nearly 500,000 quake-affected people in Turkey and Syria, providing hot meals, emergency ready-to-eat food packages, and family food rations. From UN partner, the International Committee of the Red Cross, Fabrizio Carboni described the scale of needs in Syria's Aleppo.
For the first time, I saw that there was not only cracks in the buildings, but for the first time, I really saw that colleagues, the people we talked to in Syria, that they were really wounded and something is broken.
To the Democratic Republic of the Congo, DRC, whose more than 1 million refugees need humanitarian help urgently. The alert from the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, and 69 aid partners accompanies an appeal for $605 million. This funding is needed to provide direct assistance to seven African countries where Congolese refugees are sheltering, victims of one of the continent's most intractable crises, particularly in eastern DRC, where more than 100 armed groups operate. Uganda remains the largest host country of refugees from the DRC. In 2022 alone, attacks by militia in the east uprooted 98,000 refugees to Uganda, which is now home to almost 500,000 Congolese. In Ukraine, almost a year since the Russian invasion, nearly 780 attacks on healthcare services have been reported, the UN Health Agency said on Friday. One in three people can no longer afford the medicines they need, and 10 million suffer from mental health problems, said Dr. Hans Kluge, World Health Organization Regional Director for Europe. In a statement of solidarity for the people of Ukraine, the WHO official stressed that each and every community had overwhelming needs for mental health and psychosocial support services. Dr. Kluge also stressed how much additional support was needed to treat conflict-related injuries to adults and children alike. To help, the UN Health Agency is working with nearly 200 partners to deliver services right across the country. Some 8.5 million people received health assistance last year. This year, the target is 13.6 million. To make this happen, WHO will require $240 million, $160 million for Ukraine and $80 million for refugee-receiving countries. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
The lid is on, I'm Conor Lennon. One of the main reasons that people choose to move to another country is increasingly the climate crisis. Millions of people are either forced to migrate because of a climate disaster, and millions more are affected by the slower-moving environmental changes that leave their homes uninhabitable. Think about desertification, for example, ever warmer summers, or rising sea levels. And there's an undeniable link between climate change and conflict. As tensions rise between communities and countries, sharing resources such as water, which are becoming scarcer year on year. Felipe González Morales has been the UN Special Rapporteur on the Human Rights of Migrants since 2017. He's an independent rights expert appointed by the UN Human Rights Council, and he's here in the studio with me now. Hello, Mr. González, and
Hello.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
We're speaking here in New York. You briefed the UN General Assembly in October. You expressed concern about the lack of consistent policies to address the impact of the climate emergency on migration. So, first of all, what were the things, the problems you were seeing, the inconsistencies, and what would you like to see?
Well, thank you very much for the invitation to talk about this issue. The United Nations indeed is conducted a number of initiatives regarding climate change. But I think that it's very important to ensure that the human rights component in regard of migrants is taken into account when addressing this issue. My predecessor presented a report on this matter 10 years ago. In a way, what I have done is trying to assess what progress has been made and what are the remaining, to be sure, big challenges. And what I have found based on many contributions from UN agencies, states, civil society, is that in fact a lot of challenges remain, that there have been initiatives by a number of states, but I won't say that that is really the rule in terms of addressing the impact of climate change on the situation of the human rights of migrants. So in a way, my report is trying to call on the attention of the countries in the United Nations to address this matter in a more consistent manner.
You said that that is not happening right now. So what would you like to see from the member states? What would be the best way to bring these problems in line with what you're saying, to making sure that the human rights of migrants are respected?
Well, let me start by saying that I think it was a good step forward, the fact that in the Global Compact for Migration, this issue was explicitly addressed. I think that is important. But what I haven't seen much really are coordinated efforts by states in regard to climate change in connection to the human rights of migrants. Of course, there are initiatives of states with regard to other aspects of migration, but not much regarding this one. So, for instance, the good practices that I mentioned in the report are mostly initiatives from this and that country on specific matters, but not really comprehensive approaches by states. And in this regard, of course, one key aspect is the issue of to what extent the Convention on Refugees may apply to persons escaping from climate disasters. But that is not the only point. Many times that the whole discussion evolves around that. But there are many other measures that can be adopted by states, including humanitarian visas, different kind of permits to open regular pathways for migrants who are escaping from climate change events. So it's not only a binary approach, refugee or not refugee, really. There are a number of measures that could be adopted by states.
Well, we've seen countries, richer countries, making it harder than ever before to allow migrants to come in, or even to allow them to call for asylum in that country. It seems that attitudes towards migrants are becoming more hostile in many countries. Is that your experience since 2017?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, I have seen that. When I started in 2017, the situation was already a difficult one, but I think that the obstacles for regular migration have increased over the last 5 years.
Which goes directly against what the UN is trying to do, have secure, regular pathways for migration.
Right, right. And the fact is that more than three-quarters of the states of the UN adopted the Global Compact for Migration, but I think that I see a disparity in the implementation of the compact between countries.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I think that there were many interests in the different interests in the adoption of the compact. For some countries, this was really a matter of enhancing the human rights of migrants. For others, it was a manner, for instance, to try to put in place some provisions to legitimize the return of migrants to their countries of origin and other interests. So the fact that the compact includes so many provisions of so many matters allows states to pick this and that option, and sometimes not addressing directly the most complex issues, really.
And when we come back to climate change, do you find that most countries do accept that this is a really serious driver of migration, or is there still resistance? Are there still some countries that don't accept that it's the problem that we all believe it is?
Well, I guess that is the case, but it's usually it's not that usually can, states are not explicit about it. For instance, yesterday when I presented my report, there was virtually no controversy about the report. States supported the report and were asking me about good practices and so forth. Well, in most of my reports, there have been a lot of discussion when I present reports on pushbacks, for instance, or returns of migrants and migratory detention and so forth. I would say that in the case of climate change, the situation is rare than some states look to the other side, really. They are not explicit in questioning climate change, but they are not really following this approach.
Do you think climate change is really a fundamental issue for elements, not just of migration, but internal displacement, refugees, because it is such a cross-cutting area, isn't it? You must be in contact with many of your colleagues, your fellow special rapporteurs, because I was speaking to, for example, the rapporteur on internally displaced persons, and climate change was a big part of the work that she's doing.
Absolutely. I think it has an impact, climate change has an impact on human mobility in different manners. It's just that my mandate is focused on international migration, but of course there is an issue of internal migration that is also at stake here, and displacement of persons and so forth.
Well, you've had your mandate since 2017. How much time do you have left in the post, and what do you want to achieve between now and then?
I plan to have a last report focused on regularization of migrants, which I think is a key aspect, because in addition to the issue of establishing regular pathways for migration, there is the issue of those migrants who are already in the countries of destination and who have remained sometimes decades in an irregular situation. So I will try to end with a positive note, gather information about good experiences in this regard, to try to show that regularization of migrants is really something that can enhance the society or the culture as a whole, and it's not only a matter of for the human rights of migrants, but also it's a contribution to the society. So I think that would be an important final step, in addition to trying to make a final assessment about the implementation of the Global Compact and how to enhance that implementation.
It's a funny job, isn't it, being an independent UN human rights expert, you're sort of, you know, with the organization, but also a step apart from the organization.
Right.
Do you feel like you can have a real impact? Do you feel like you've been able to make a difference?
Yes, I think that the whole system of special procedures that I have followed for decades is a very important one. And of course, there are many situations in where you don't have the impact that you would be seeking, but there are many cases in which that really occurs. And it is not only because of the relationship with the states, but also because we, the special rapporteurs, have a strong engagement with the civil society as well, and that serves as a channel to improve the situation in the countries as well.
And are you confident that we can reach a situation internationally where it is more secure to migrate, where there are these clear pathways that we're looking for, and that we see reduction in the kind of tragedies that we've seen over the last few years, which seem to be getting worse right now?
Right. It has to be. I mean, I have the experience. I grew up in during the dictatorship of Pinochet in Chile. I saw the continuing pressure and monitoring from international human rights bodies at times when it didn't look at all that we would escape from that situation. And I think that that international actions really made a difference. And I think that we have to pursue that avenue, and in that way we will be able to make progress.
This is the News in Brief from the United Nations. The UN has launched a $1 billion humanitarian appeal for the people of Turkey, who are still reeling from one of the most devastating earthquakes to hit the country in a century. The funding covers a three-month period and will assist 5.2 million people. Aid organizations will use the money to scale up vital support for government-led relief efforts rapidly in food security, protection, education, water and shelter. Launching the appeal, UN Chief Antonio Guterres noted that Turkey is home to the largest number of refugees in the world and has shown enormous generosity to its Syrian neighbors for years. Now is the time for the world to support the people of Turkey, just as they have stood in solidarity with others seeking assistance, Mr. Guterres said. Staying with the UN Secretary-General, who warned on Thursday that a staggering 78 million girls and boys around the world don't go to school at all today because of conflict, climate disasters and displacement. In a call for more funding for education in emergencies, the UN chief insisted that no one should be denied their chance to learn. In total, 222 million children face obstacles to education. To help them, 18 countries and private partners pledged $826 million for the UN Global Fund Education Cannot Wait. UN Special Envoy for Global Education, Gordon Brown, explained why help is needed so urgently.
We are talking about the most isolated, the most desolate, the most neglected children of the world. We're talking about girls who will find themselves trafficked or forced into child labour or into child marriage unless we can help them.
To the Horn of Africa now, where urgent life-saving assistance is needed for the many migrants heading to Gulf states via Djibouti and Yemen, the UN Migration Agency, IOM, has warned. Latest data from the UN agency indicates that the number of migrants who entered Djibouti almost doubled from 2021 to 2022. The so-called Eastern Migration Route is one of the most dangerous in the world, where many deaths go unreported, IOM said. In a call for help on Thursday, IOM Director General Antonio Vitorino said that the situation was a forgotten crisis, but migrants deserve support and to be treated with dignity, Mr. Vitorino insisted, in support of an appeal for $84 million to help the more than 1 million migrants and the communities hosting them in the region. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
I was out with the team all day in Aleppo, visiting our clinics, visiting makeshift shelters, talking to people on the ground, our partners, everyone involved in the emergency response. It's very difficult for me to capture in a single sentence or a paragraph and paint a picture for you of the level and scale of disaster that we're seeing. It's not just the physical destruction that is compounded by over a decade of conflict and war. There are buildings that have collapsed, entire streets that have been demolished, but it's the cumulative exhaustion of a people who have been fighting for their vital existence and now feel that the very moment that they're starting to return to some normalcy and see hope and light at the end of the tunnel, the natural disaster, this massive earthquake, has literally crumbled their hopes the way that the buildings have crumbled during the earthquake itself.
This is so sad. As we know, UNFPA pays special attention to women and girls. What is the fund currently doing on the ground to alleviate the impact of this humanitarian disaster on women and girls?
You know, the majority of people who are in the shelters and who are displaced in northern Syria and northwest Syria are women and girls. So even prior to the earthquake, we had a number of initiatives with our partners on the ground that provided safe delivery, maternal health services, protection from gender-based violence. Those have had to scale up massively. We've had to also integrate and expand our programs to extend to the makeshift shelters, mosques and schools and parks that have been turned into places where I say shelter, but I use the term loose. None of these makeshift shelters are equipped for human residents. They lack water. They lack good sanitation, electricity, heating. It was cold, it was dark in some places, but we are trying with our partners on the ground to provide vital services. We have dignity kits that have gone out, 39,000 to the women here in Aleppo alone, and they are for pregnant women, for families who've been displaced. It provides them with basic hygiene products. It provides them with a change of clothing. something that they can also share with their family and give them a sense of normalcy, dignity, and integrity. We also work with our partners to provide medical equipment in the two hospitals that are still functioning. And we are working hand in hand with the rest of the United Nations team here on the ground to ensure a better coordination amongst our services so that the most needy get the quickest service. It is a massive operation and beyond compare, and nothing that one single agency or one single country can possibly cope with, though.
The Secretary General and the UN as a whole welcomed the decision by the Syrian President Bashar Assad to open the Bab al-Hawa or Bab al-Salam and al-Ra'i crossing. And this is to facilitate, of course, the entry of humanitarian aid. How will this affect the fund's operation on the ground?
I think it'll have a very positive impact on our operations. The two crossing points that were opened, and we thank all the parties involved, both for the opening from the Syrian government, also the lifting of temporary sanctions, and the Turkish government for their collaboration. And I think that this is a very key note about how reconciliation can begin. Finally, we have a point where everyone converges on the need to help those who need our help. And it is unbiased. It is blind to anything except for the humanitarian assistance. Today, a massive convoy went across the border into Idlib. It was UNFPA was not part of this one, but we still had boots on the ground. And in the next convoy, we will be part of it, delivering equipment for the hospitals. We'll be delivering more dignity kits for the people who've been displaced. And we will also strengthen our people and coordination on the ground, because there's a sense of duty of care to our providers as well. Please don't forget that these are people who they themselves have been traumatized, and yet they work tirelessly through the night. We have staff members who've been sleeping in their cars for 8 days, just moving around from place to place after they finish work and donating their time. But that requires also a little bit of time and energy after all of that adrenaline dissipates, and much clearer coordination and planning with those involved. We hope that that will be the next stage of what we deliver.
So too. We heard and saw, as everyone saw, the recent rescued baby in Turkey several days after the earthquake. And that was indeed a good news, a very good news to everyone. Any similar good news from Syria?
You know, there's always good news if you look for it. And I think people are waiting for a ray of hope. The Syrian people are very industrious. They love life. And today I met a woman who was a grandmother at a very early age. Her house was not damaged. Her house was destroyed, along with that of her daughters, in the earthquake. Her daughter is a young mother of 20 who ended up in the hospital with a broken pelvis and two broken legs. And she herself was the mother of an 8-month-old baby boy, her first. Despite the fact that the house was destroyed, the young mother lost her son, and the grandmother was a widow. The two women and the baby are safe. We were able to provide direct assistance for the mother to recover, and I'm happy to report that despite the fact that she's a bit broken, she will recover. The grandmother is safe and sound with the baby, and has had both medical and psychosocial counseling, and remains with one of our partners to help her with shelter and other needs. And we hope that the family reunification will take place very soon. And I think that this is a really shining example of how, when the community comes together with the assistance of the United Nations, that we can do good out of the most desperate situations.
Now, more than a week after the earthquake, do you have a better picture of the extent of the damage in Syria?
It doesn't take an assessment to really see the extent of the damage. You drive into the city, and if I could paint you a picture, it is one of a city that had grace and beauty at one time, but has been completely demolished and ravaged by 11 years of war and now by this earthquake. It is poor. It is marginalized. It is crumbling. And you can see the impact of this cumulative pressure that has been imposed by the sanctions, the isolation, the war, the physical damage, the tearing apart of the social structure. And we hope that it's not just the assessment of how many people. We have a clearer assessment of that. What really is important is an assessment of how we're going to start on the reconciliation and rebuilding of both the people and the country. And I think that that's where the focus of what we are doing as it evolves. The UNFPA will be hand in hand with all of our partners, looking at the needs of reproductive health, maternal health, protection from gender-based violence for all the women and girls, wherever they may be in Syria.
What do you tell, what message would you send to the Syrian people and also to the international community?
I'm going to tell you exactly what I asked the women everywhere that I went. I said, if I could tell the international community one thing, what would you have me tell them? And without fault, in every group of women, individual or collective, their message was the same. We've had enough. We are exhausted and we want reconciliation. We want peace. And we hope that during this very dark moment, that it will be a moment where everyone's hearts and minds are open to the possibilities of peace.
This is the News in Brief from the United Nations. Almost a year since the full-scale Russian invasion of Ukraine, the UN appealed on Wednesday for $5.6 billion to help millions of people affected inside the war-torn country and beyond. The situation for many in Ukraine remains desperate amid relentless shelling of civilian targets and infrastructure, the UN's Emergency Relief Coordinator Martin Griffiths told journalists in Geneva. He explained that funding was needed to continue supporting life-saving aid convoy deliveries to communities on the front line into areas of great danger and difficulty and priority needs. Echoing that call, Felipe Grandi, UN High Commissioner for Refugees, described the daily dangers faced by people caught up in the war.
Civilian infrastructure constantly being hit and destroyed. I've seen kindergarten flattened and old people living in cellars because of the danger of bombing. So after 1 year, I think we're becoming a little bit used to this. We shouldn't, because it's quite appalling what the Russian invasion is doing to the country.
A no less urgent appeal now, this time for Syria, where the UN says that close to 9 million people have been affected by last week's devastating earthquakes. To help them, relief agencies need $397 million to assist the most vulnerable for the next 3 months. The earthquake damage is worst in the northwest, with more than 4.2 million people affected in Aleppo, along with another 3 million in Idlib. More than 7,400 buildings have been completely or partially destroyed. Water, electricity, heating and social services are under severe pressure, according to the UN Aid Coordination Office, OCHA, which also underlined the high risk of waterborne disease while a nationwide cholera outbreak continues. To Bangladesh, where too little is being done to protect leprosy patients from needless suffering, a top UN-appointed independent rights expert said on Wednesday. Alice Cruz, Special Rapporteur on the Elimination of Discrimination Against People with Leprosy, said that the disease continues to be hidden beneath layers of institutional neglect. She commended the Bangladeshi authorities' commitment to eliminate leprosy by 2030, but expressed concern about delayed diagnoses, ongoing transmission, and disability among children, along with widespread stigma associated with the disease. People with leprosy and their families are still not enjoying the benefits of economic growth, nor are they seeing discrimination against them redressed, said the Special Rapporteur, who reports to the Human Rights Council in Geneva. According to the UN Health Agency, WHO, Bangladesh has the fifth highest leprosy caseload in the world. In an effort to tackle another scourge, online disinformation and hate speech, the UN Cultural, Educational and Scientific Agency, UNESCO, is spearheading a bid to establish ground rules for social media platforms. Ball rolling, thousands of representatives of governments, regulatory bodies, digital companies, academia and civil society will convene at UNESCO headquarters in Paris next week. The work of the Internet for Trust Global Conference will be driven by human rights considerations, and in particular, freedom of expression, said Audrey Azoulay, Director General of UNESCO. The agency said that it recognized the revolutionary value of social media platforms, but noted that the algorithms that are integral to most social media platforms often prioritize engagement over safety and human rights. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
Today I am in Znamyanka in Kirovograd Oblast. Znamyanka is a very important point as it has a train station and the railway is coming from Donetsk Oblast. So in the recent months, there has been many evacuees coming from Donetsk and from the very volatile areas in Donetsk Oblast.
So you say volatile. Of course, we've had a year of war now. What are you seeing when you get closer to the contact line, that very long contact line, 1,000 kilometers or so in the east?
Well, of course, first and foremost, we see heavy fighting on both sides. Once we go there with the interagency convoys with humanitarian assistance, it's filled with military personnel, military equipment. And of course, we see damage, like 80-90% or even more damaged towns. Some actually, you could say, doesn't even exist anymore.
So you're saying whole cities, whole towns, that's what the UN's emergency relief chief, Martin Griffiths, told the Security Council back at the start of February. So what are the actual needs now? What has a year of war resulted in for Ukrainians day to day? What's their day to day existence like?
Well, at the moment, we are talking about nearly 18 million people. That's almost 40% of the Ukraine population in need of humanitarian assistance. This both includes in the western part of Ukraine, of course, to a lesser extent, the center and north, but mainly in the southern parts and eastern parts of Ukraine, where we also have the front line at the moment. Of course, during the winter, luckily it's been a somewhat mild winter compared to Ukrainian standards. But of course, there's been a lot of support in terms of making sure people actually could stay warm. They had basic humanitarian assistance, such as food, hygiene items, winter clothes, solar lamps, as people are really staying down in the bunkers on an everyday basis, especially in these areas where there's constant shelling on a daily basis.
So it's still a very live war, you're saying, and it's still not getting better.
No, I think actually in the frontline locations like Soledar, Bakhmut, where again we are seeing a lot of the IDPs here in Znamyanka coming from, these places are actually getting worse and with increased fighting on a day-to-day basis. People simply have to stay down in the basements, in the shelters, where of course it's cold, it's damp, there's no electricity. In these frontline locations, there is simply no electricity. We as IOM are of course trying to support as much as possible. This also includes establishing heating points with generators so people can have a bit of warmth during the winter time. Of course, these people are extremely resilient. I see it when I'm on missions. I met an old pensioner from Soledar who said she had experienced the Second World War. She would see war again. That was, of course, very heartbreaking. This is one of the people that is out of these frontline locations, but there are still many, many thousands of people living in these areas as they simply have no other ways to leave or go somewhere else. And in the Ukrainian culture, the house and the location where people live is extremely important.
Well, I think we can understand that people's homes are where their memories are, and a lot of people can't leave, as you say. But what about those beyond the contact line in Russian-held territory? Have you been able to get over there? Because there are huge concerns that there are still many thousands of people who desperately need humanitarian aid.
Yes, of course. On the other side, there's also incredible humanitarian needs. At the moment, the UN has not been able to access these areas. So this is, of course, something that I'm sure the people in New York and Geneva and so on are working hard on, see if we can gain access to these locations as well.
So let's focus on the work that you are managing to do. You say that you're providing generators, you're bringing humanitarian relief. How many millions of people are you actually helping within Ukraine at the moment, Johannes?
We are aware, of course, that nearly 8 million has fled to neighboring countries. We have 5.3 million IDPs, internally displaced persons, within Ukraine. We, as IOM, of course, are supporting war-affected communities and the people staying behind, but we are also supporting especially IDPs in regions further away from the front line. So this is, for example, here in the eastern region. This could be in regions like Poltava and Dnipro, Kirovograd, where I am at now. So we are, for example, supporting so far 102 collective centers with various types of support, improving living conditions inside the collective centers, light, medium repairs, hygiene items, support to site managers with cash. And also we have, of course, supported with many what we call emergency shelter kits for people staying in damaged apartments or houses. We have also been distributing cash to over 70,000 people that are very close to the frontline locations. One other special big concern is support to mental health. This is especially first and foremost to people in the frontline locations, but also people who are on the move 1 year after the war broke out. This is really, you know, in how people's mindsets are. They try to adapt, but after some time, of course, they need support in talking about their emotions and feelings. And this not only includes people in these frontline locations, but also veterans and the families coming back from the war.
Final question to you, Johannes, from the UN Migration Agency. I know that you're working as hard as you can and you're reaching as many people as you can, but have you got the resources that you need and are you reaching as many as you want?
Well, look, I think especially since, you know, 2-3 months ago when the Russians started attacking and destroying critical infrastructure, that was, of course, massive scale up that we had to do in terms of support with generators, with water pumps to water systems and these kind of things. I think the attacks are ongoing on these things. We've seen recent attacks now over the weekend, new attacks in Kharkiv City. We had a very heartbreaking attack in Dnipro a few weeks ago. With the risk of a new offensive, of course, we would need more assistance, more support from countries and donors.
This is the News in Brief from the United Nations. As UN aid convoys prepared to deliver more relief to quake-hit northwest Syria on Tuesday, UN humanitarians warned that thousands of children have likely been killed, while millions more vulnerable people urgently need support. From the UN Children's Fund UNICEF, spokesperson James Elder warned that cases of hypothermia and respiratory infections are on the rise among youngsters, as he appealed for continued solidarity with all those affected by the emergency.
Everyone everywhere needs more support, more safe water, more warmth, more shelter, more fuel, more electricity, more medicines, more funding. Families with children up there sleeping in the streets, malls, schools, mosques, under bridges, staying out in the open because of fear of returning to their homes.
To Tunisia, where the country's deepening crackdown against political opponents and civil society has been condemned by UN Rights Chief Volker Türk. Since Saturday, at least 9 people have been reportedly arrested and some detained on security and corruption charges, the High Commissioner for Human Rights said in a statement. Criminal charges have included conspiracy against state security, said Mr. Türk, who expressed concern that military courts had been used to try some of those being held. Those arrested include former civil servants and a former finance minister, opposition party members, 2 judges, a former human rights minister, a law professor and a blogger, according to the High Commissioner's office. Infectious disease control experts from the UN Health Agency, WHO, have been deployed to Equatorial Guinea to help contain the country's first outbreak of Marburg virus. 9 people have reportedly died from the virus in western Kinatem province. Marburg is from the same family as the Ebola virus. Its symptoms include fever, fatigue and blood-stained vomit and diarrhea. To support the national response, WHO has provided expertise in epidemiology, case management, infection prevention and risk communication to build trust with affected communities. In Geneva on Tuesday, the WHO also convened an emergency meeting of its Marburg virus vaccine consortium. Although there are no vaccines or antiviral treatments for the virus, a number of vaccine candidates are in the early stages of testing. A range of other potential treatments also exists, including blood products, immune and drug therapies. And finally, a call from UN agriculture experts to improve the management of grasslands for the sake of our shared climate goals. According to the Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, soils are the second largest carbon store on the planet after oceans. This means that they already play an important role in climate change mitigation, but if grasslands were tended to better than they are currently, they could store much more carbon, keeping it from entering the atmosphere, FAO researchers have insisted. The other benefits of better grasslands management include new insights into food security and biodiversity conservation, FAO said in a call for further research. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
I'm currently in Ankara and supporting the 6 disaster zones that are in the south of Turkey. And what is crucial now is to make a final push. All 10,000 rescuers, boots on the ground with 330 search dogs, are supporting the full effort of the national responders in still hoping for miracle rescues that are taking place in the last hours of this response. By the same time, what we know is the crucial relief phase that will be kicking in as we speak. Huge needs for shelter, for warm clothing, for heating, for food, water is crucial to sustain and to make sure the population continues to make sure that they are fully well supported, especially in this time and in the bitter cold.
Sure. And just remind me and remind our listeners the scale of the damage in Turkey.
The scale and the damage of Turkey is one of the worst we have seen. We are looking at a damaged area of over 150,000 square kilometers, covering a span of 10 provinces. And we are looking at over, as we count now, 6,000 collapsed high-rise buildings. And the time of the disaster, as we all know, was 4:17 a.m. Most people are still in deep sleep and slumber. And that is where a huge number of victims, they are still entombed, buried in various collapsed structures. And that's where our target of rescue is in full force.
Are you still hearing, a week after the quake, miracle rescues?
Well, definitely. There are constant reports of miracle rescues in the last few days. I mean, we have notably rescued a mother and a child. We have heard stories of a newborn baby still in the umbilical cord coming out alive. There's still a lot of hope. And what we do see, in spite of the bitter cold, is the warm hospitality and reception by the Turkish people. They have been very welcoming to the international rescuers, keeping them warm with tea and making sure that all necessary support on the field is provided to make sure our technical experts are doing what they do best, augment the national rescue teams in the life-saving phase of response.
So you're still saving people and you're with the UN Disaster Assessment and Coordination Unit. Behind you, just describe the scene, please. You've got, it looks like a huge hall with lots of people manning telephones.
This is the central Turkish National Emergency Management Center. It's operating 24/7. And right from the start, ministerial team here, the Vice President of Turkey is here. We have 25 different disaster groups spanning across all sectors from environmental, medical, the military, of course, disaster response coordination. And they're all here, united, working in strong synergies for one thing, to make sure the most and worst affected people are receiving the aid they need.
And you, as part of the UN Disaster Assessment Coordination Group, you are helping to mobilize these emergency teams, these urban search and rescue teams with their sniffer dogs, and you've talked about 10,000 rescuers out there. I mean, is that enough? We've heard of, you know, this massive damage, and then moving south to Gaziantep, which is a valuable UN strategic logistics hub, which was also damaged. And then there's moving further south towards Syria. There's great concern about all those people, the 4 million in northwestern Syria. Are they getting enough aid? Are you able to get through?
Well, definitely the needs are unprecedented. We have never seen such a scale. The last was the Indian Ocean tsunami of 2004 with 220,000 dead. And I think this one does not pale in comparison because of the different challenges we face. The bitter winter, for one, is really bringing a big challenge. The roads, the security situation, as we know, the complexities in Syria, all these are posing a huge challenge to our rescue teams. But nevertheless, our rescue teams are unrelenting. They are moving forward. We have a full UN team here supporting the RC's office. We are moving forward best we can. Together, we can bring the necessary aid, especially life-saving aid at this point. As we speak, it's still the urban search and rescue teams that are front and center because we are still seeing miracles happening, miracle rescues that are taking place. digging people who are buried alive because of structural collapse of high-rise residential buildings. More than 6,000 buildings have collapsed. So a huge amount of work. And that is why till now, as we speak, we are into day 8, we are looking at the Turkish authorities still welcoming international search and rescue teams to augment and to support this life-saving phase.
Yeah, you talk about international support. There's certainly willingness on many levels, but you just mentioned yourself, there's not enough heavy machinery. There are certainly concerns about not enough fuel to fire up these big heavy plant machines that are needed to lift the big slabs of concrete off people. So what's the progress on that? And I guess another question is, if you don't have more access into northern Syria via another crossing, isn't there going to be a huge traffic jam because 4 convoys have got through, but so much more is needed?
Well, the challenges are there for sure in terms of access and in terms of needs. But what we do see is a strong solidarity, a global solidarity of member countries coming forward. We have established a joint coordination cell with the European Union. We are pushing relief items into the country, and this scale of solidarity has not been seen for a very, very long time. The Under Secretary General is here in this region, and he's touring and making sure that we have the access we need to the people in need.
This is the News in Brief from the United Nations. In Turkey, 6,000 high-rise buildings are known to have collapsed in last week's earthquake disaster, UN rescue experts said on Monday, as chances diminish of finding any further survivors. Winston Chang from the UN Disaster Assessment and Coordination Team, UNDAC, said that 10,000 rescuers are on the ground in the 10 southern provinces affected by the emergency in Turkey.
Well, definitely the needs are unprecedented. We have never seen such a scale. The last was the Indian Ocean tsunami of 2004 with 220,000 dead. And I think this one does not pale in comparison because of the different challenges we face. The bitter winter, for one, is really bringing a big challenge. The roads, the security situation, as we know, the complexities in Syria, all these are posing a huge challenge to our rescue team.
More than 4,300 deaths have been reported in northwest Syria by Sunday, the 12th of February, since an earthquake of 7.7 magnitude struck southern Turkey on the 6th of February. UN Aid Coordination Agency OCHA said that Harim, Afrin and Jebel Saman are the worst affected districts in northwest Syria, and that 52 trucks loaded with aid from 5 UN agencies have so far arrived via the Seoul International Crossing at Bab el-Hawa from Turkey. Priority needs include heavy machines to remove fallen concrete, medical supplies, shelter and non-food items, including heating, emergency food and clean water and sanitation assistance. The closure of one of Cambodia's last independent news outlets has been condemned by the UN Rights Chief Volker Turk. The High Commissioner for Human Rights said in a statement that he was alarmed that the license for Voice of Democracy had been revoked on Monday. That decision came after Cambodia's Prime Minister Hun Sen reportedly said that he'd been hurt by a story published by Voice of Democracy. In an appeal to the government of Cambodia to rescind the decision, Mr. Turk said that the move appeared arbitrary, as it was not preceded by a thorough and transparent process, as required under Cambodia's own press law. To Iraq, where the construction of a memorial marking the genocide of the Yazidi ethnic minority at the hands of ISIL fighters began this week. With the help of UN Migration Agency IOM and the US Agency for International Development, a cemetery and lasting memorial are being built in Sinjar province. It was there in August 2014 that ISIL groups attacked and killed thousands of ethnic Yazidi in a systematic attempt to erase them from existence, the UN Migration Agency said. Survivors of the atrocity have welcomed the project, including Nobel laureate Nadia Murad, a UN Goodwill Ambassador who for years has campaigned for justice for all Yazidi people. Grief is part of the healing process, said Ms. Murad, founder and president of Nadia's Initiative, which launched the project in 2021. She added that having a place to collectively mourn and remember our families, friends and neighbours is vital for survivors, especially those who've returned to Sinjar. It also serves an educational purpose, she said, reminding the world of what our community suffered and how we must continue to focus on preventing such atrocities. Israel's systematic and deliberate demolition of housing built by Palestinians and its building of settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories should be halted, UN independent rights experts said on Monday. Special Rapporteur Francesca Albanese said that in January alone, Israeli authorities reportedly demolished 132 Palestinian structures across 38 communities in the occupied West Bank. This included 34 residential and 15 donor-funded structures and represents a 135% increase compared to the same period in 2022, the rights expert continued, while also condemning the systematic denial of building permits for Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. In the southern West Bank's Masafer Yatta, the rights expert insisted that 1,100 Palestinian residents remain at imminent risk of forced eviction, arbitrary displacement, and demolitions of their homes, livelihood, water, and sanitation structures. Despite raising these concerns with the Israeli authorities, no response has been forthcoming, Ms. Albanese said. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
Thank you very much, Reem, for inviting me to this important interview. The destruction is really very, very massive. And the devastation is indescribable, my words. The earthquake hit at a time when we talk about Syria. And definitely, I mean, Turkey have suffered the same, you know. But for Syria, it hit at a time when needs in Syria, the whole Syria, and for the whole Syrian people are at the highest since the conflict began 12 years back. Examples, almost 50% of the healthcare facilities are not functioning. And several hospitals are affected by this earthquake, in addition to what have been, you know, affected by the war itself. With important medical equipment that are destroyed by the earthquake, we have seen CT scans that have been installed from the 1990s. Functioning until last week, you know, with the earthquake, and then no more functioning. Even the resolution is of a very poor quality, but they are still using it. Some CT scans and MRIs are not really working because items and spare parts are not available, you know, due to the war and the difficulties, you know, that linked with that. Briefly speaking, the needs are really huge. We estimate that around 25 million people have been impacted by the earthquake in the whole of Syria. In Aleppo, for example, initial estimations of the numbers indicate that more than 200,000 people are now homeless. We have met many of them. We have visited many of these damaged areas, and we have seen people living, you know, under the shade of the sky in a very cold weather. We have seen families, you know, in fact, one family of 16 members living in one tent. We have seen families backed in stadiums, families backed in shelters that are very small rooms, children and women together living in a very tight room. So that the hugs are really, you know, the needs are really huge. Some people are missing their medications for their, diabetes, hypertension. Some are missing medications for cancer.
With the huge needs, Dr. Mandari, there is criticism that the aid is not enough and didn't come to Syria fast enough. What would you say about WHO's response?
I mean, for us, we have been, as a WHO, but definitely other UN agencies, but I'm talking about WHO, we have been there on the ground, broadly speaking, from day one. Other UN agencies, alhamdulillah, we met them, you know, for the last 5 days I was there and the last 2 days with the Digi, we met them on the ground. The needs are really very huge. We as the WHO, we managed to provide, you know, supplies from day one, as I said, for example, to the northwestern part of Syria, to 16 hospitals. Through our NGOs, we mobilized our teams to go and you know, work with their counterparts in the ministries of health and the healthcare facilities. For trauma, for example, we contacted NGOs that WHO works with in terms of monitoring, surveillance, and whatever technical support that we should provide to the healthcare facilities and the staff. We talk about, say, for example, medical supplies. We provided 2 days back, shipment of 35 metric tons that are composed of trauma kits and other medical supplies for infections, like, for example, pneumonia kits. And the 37 supplies are coming in these 2 days, either today or maybe tomorrow, from our hub in Dubai. So this sort of supply, we have been negotiating with the authorities in the government-controlled areas to make sure that it is equally, fairly distributed to the healthcare facilities. For the northeast or the northern part that is hit by the earthquake, we have been working as a UN with our national and international NGOs. We have been discussing with the different authorities in these areas to grant us access, either through cross-border, supported by Security Council, whatever resolutions or declarations, and through cross-line, based on the support of the international community.
What would you say the biggest challenge your response is facing in Syria, in different parts?
One of the biggest challenges, as I said, the limited hospital capacities, either in terms of the human resources that are there currently in the health system, many have left, and those remaining are facing difficulties in terms of their capacities, getting themselves updated on the latest, evidences in medicine. The other side is the lack of the equipment and supplies, medical supplies. As I said, some MRIs are not functioning because of lack of spare parts. Angio and CT scans are not working. We visited one of the hospitals, trauma hospital, in fact, in Aleppo. They cannot do X-ray because they lack the C-arm X-ray, for example, for a patient who is brought with fractures before doing surgery or within the surgery. In one of the hospitals, they cannot do X-ray because they don't have a mobile X-ray. So they have to move the patient from his bed or her bed to the X-ray department with whatever risk. So that is challenge number one. Challenge number two, there is an ongoing fuel crisis that is not only the society itself, but the hospitals. Many hospitals are with no heating system. Many hospitals are lacking, the electricity. The third challenge that we are facing, high risk of, spreading of water and foodborne diseases due to the disrupted water supply. And a very good example is the cholera outbreak that we have had last year because of contaminated water. The other risk is, the spread of hepatitis, for example, A, because of the contaminated water and food supplies. The fourth one is the transmission of diseases in crowded shelters. We visited one of the stadiums who is full of families in Ladakia. And in fact, doctors there, they told us, now children are complaining of head lice. Head lice is started to spread between the families there because it is very, very bad one. And these are just examples of the challenges that we are facing. The other last challenge I'm worried about from now after the shock is the harsh winter weather with the extreme cold temperature. We have seen people who are living outside in tents which are not heated. And in fact, I met one old lady and I saw her hands are cracked with bruises and erosions. And when I touched her hand, it is very dry because of the cold weather and because of the lack of the heating system. So that is another worry that we should really make sure it will not happen.
Yeah. Dr. Montari, you spoke about access. Can you explain to our audience, please, this challenge of access to get the aid to the people who need it most in Syria?
Wallahi, it is a very important question, Reem. And here I'd like just to share a key message to everyone. The international community, the regional and the national community there. Syrians have suffered from 12 years of war with whatever related, issues within that without going into the detail. This earthquake came and it really made it now last crisis, Syrians, regardless of where are they located, either in the government-controlled areas or in the non-government-controlled areas. Syrians are the same, and they cannot tolerate any more shocks, you know, and crisis. We should really stand strong and say enough is enough. We cannot, as human beings, tolerate Syrians suffering from these sort of crises and losing lives. We are losing children. We are losing the future generation of Syria, as I said, regardless of where they are located. So let us bring the attention of the global community to the Syrians and make sure that we really participate in saving the lives of the Syrians with no political, religious, cultural, societal, economic affiliations. You know, human beings are the same regardless of where they are located.